This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to talk to George Church, who's a professor of genetics at the Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Hello.
We're going to talk about genetic sequencing, and we're going to talk about your involvement in it and your activities there. Could you just tell us a little bit about, starting as far back as you want, where your interest in genetic sequencing or genetics generally came from and how you pursued it?
Okay, Mark. Basically, I've been really keen on getting my own sequence and anybody else who wanted it at an affordable level, basically since I was a graduate student.
Right.
And I've been working on, you know, every approach that seemed reasonable from a scientific and engineering standpoint. Did a little bit as a graduate student developing the so-called genomic sequencing method and one of the first reading softwares, both of which were have been commercialized in various contexts.
Okay.
Since then, and then I helped start the Genome Project and many of the academic and commercial components of that.
Okay, why don't we back up a little bit and tell our listeners what genetic sequencing is?
Right. So the part of what makes our bodies are our genes encoded in A, C's, G's, and T's in our DNA. There are
right.
many other things that contribute to who we are, but that's a very increasingly simple thing to read out with automated chemistry in machines.
In essence, if we were a building, it would be the blueprint. It doesn't determine exactly how it ends up looking, but it provides the instructions for the construction.
Right. Some people like to call it a recipe. A blueprint kind of implies that it's an actual scale model, but it's really heavily encoded. It's a linear string. It's like a long message, a long
right.
text.
In this,
it tells you how to build the building rather than a picture of the building.
Right. In fact, it's a lot like the binary code that provides this message and the things on our screen. They're all ones and zeros. But when they're manifested, they become pictures or sound or whatever. And
absolutely.
And similarly, instead of ones and zeros, there are the four nucleotides that all the DNA is encoded in.
Yeah, that's a beautiful analogy.
Okay. All right. So what's so complicated about being able to read it out for any particular organism?
Well, it's becoming less and less complicated, but when, you know, in the late 70s when this was invented by Wally Gilbert and Fred Sanger, the current methods that are used are based on those origins, it was on the order of $10 a base pair to achieve it due to a highly manual components and so forth.
Right.
Each year it gets become more and more automated and smaller and smaller volumes, just like computers, it's on a learning curve.
Right, it's Moore's Law in effect.
It's very much like the Moore's Law for computers.
Right. Okay, as things now stand, if a person walks into the lab and is going to have his or her DNA sequenced, what's the procedure, both for them and then once it gets into the lab, what actually happens? What kind of machines are involved? What kind of computers are involved?
Yeah, well, first of all, very few people actually are wealthy enough to afford it right now. It costs
okay.
about $26 million to get a highly accurate human sequence,
okay.
complete sequence.
$26 million is the price right now.
That's the current price.
How many people have had them done?
Well, there's one kind of composite sequence that everybody refers to, and then there's one that's probably of a person, although it's a little bit unclear.
This is Craig Venter, isn't it?
So he, and it's also not exactly clear how much that costs, but it's in the... Today, it would cost on the order of $26 million.
So there aren't very many of these out there.
There aren't very many. But you can get pieces
right.
That correspond to your particular cancer gene or something very important to you, and that's on the order of hundreds of dollars.
So on CSI and all the other police shows, when they want to exclude or include some suspect in the investigation, they swab their epithelial cells from their cheek, and then they run a DNA check. What are they doing there? They're not running a sequencing of their whole human genome.
That's
there,
correct.
Are they?
They're looking at 13 fairly randomly. They're always the same 13 places, but they're not particularly significant with respect to your genetics. They're things that are very easy to tell one person from another. They're like fingerprints.
Right.
But they're just—it's really just a handful of bits. It's not the 3 billion base pairs that you need to define a person. They're just 13 very informative snippets of information.
Right, which vary greatly from person to person and make make identification or exclusion relatively easy. Okay.
That's
right. So in the case if you were going to do this, have you done this for yourself yet, or you don't have $26 million?
I'm working hard on bringing the cost well below that so that we can all afford it.
Okay.
I haven't done it with myself yet.
Okay. Now what are
I'm in line.
Okay. Now what are the elements that need to that what costs so much now? And what could each of those, and what could, how could each of those elements be made less expensive?
So, the main thing that's brought the price down so far has been reducing the labor costs. But now we're getting to the point where it's almost completely automated, and the real costs are the equipment amortization. I mean,
right.
That is to say, you've got an expensive piece of equipment, and even though it's not going as fast as the computer can go. So it's limited by the chemistry of DNA running through these narrow capillary tubes.
Right.
And that's slow. The computer can go at a billion operations per second, and these things are going sort of on the order of one operation per second. So the computer is really idle. And this very expensive machine, it's about $300,000, is going about a billion times slower than the computer would like.
No, would it be possible to buy more machines that they can do more things, so they can have less of each?
That'll allow you to go faster, but it won't allow you to go cheaper. It just means you'll burn money much faster.
Right. Oh, okay.
So in order to get the cost down, you need to either bring down the cost of the instrument, or you make the instrument go as fast as possible, as fast as the PC goes.
So what's limiting its throughput now?
It's limited by the rate at which the DNA runs through the capillaries.
And you can't push them faster?
its speed has been increased maybe about tenfold over the years, but it's hit its limit right now.
So are we at sort of basic biological limits or at engineering limits?
This is just one particular method.
Right.
Each method, as in many industries, even in the semiconductor industry, you'll use a little method for a while, has this S-shaped growth curve, and then it plateaus, and you bring in another method, and it gets better.
What's the current method called for this mechanism?
It would be called capillary electrophoretic terminator sequencing.
Okay. Now, are there other methods to do this? You know, what exactly is happening in that process, and how could it be done by another process?
Yeah, there are many ways to sequence DNA that are actually in commercial use right now. Some of them look like they are early on the learning curve, and then they have maybe more growth potential than the capillary electrophoretic method.
Okay. So, what are some of those?
So, for example, there's a company called Lynx in Hayward, California, uses a method by which they degrade the DNA in a cyclic manner, and that you monitor the fluorescence of that.
And is that work faster than the current capillary method?
I think the general sentiment is that it is less expensive.
Less expensive.
And faster. I mean,
less expensive and faster.
Right.
All right. And where is that on the developmental curve? Is it being tested?
That's been in production for a few years now. It's mostly been used for custom jobs for pharmaceutical companies.
Now, there's a parallel problem or solution right now. I'm covering this flu vaccine issue, and it turns out more people now know that vaccines are made in supposedly sterile eggs from chickens, and this is a kind of archaic way of making vaccine, apparently, and there may be more modern ways, although they haven't been put to use yet in this case. This is kind of the same issue here. You're working with these biological organisms or parts of them that have that to manipulate them requires very precise and very complicated behavior, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analogy. I mean, it's definitely with every technology, not just the biological ones.
Right.
There are moments where you feel that everything's very archaic, and you can see on the horizon some incredible hope, and very often it arrives. certainly has in the computer industry now for almost 100 years.
Right, because you'd think instead of injecting eggs and harvesting the virus and so on, you could put them in a big vat, for example, like beer, and mix them up that way. But apparently, obviously, that doesn't work because they would have been doing it that way. So they're looking for other methods to propagate viruses. It's not exactly the same as checking DNA. But
I think the field of pharmaceuticals and vaccines is a little more risk-averse than, say, the computing industry.
Right.
You know, and the World Wide Web can appear on the scene in 1 year,
right,
1993.
Right.
To make a major change in vaccines and pharmaceuticals requires a great deal more care because people's lives are really on the line. And,
right.
And even a risk of one person in 100,000 dying,
right,
that didn't need to is not acceptable. But when you're talking about getting information or exchanging information, there you see societal changes that happen overnight.
Okay,
like file sharing and all that sort of stuff.
All right, although we're not making jokes about it. Viruses, computer viruses aren't any good either.
True. They do effectively kill people by consuming resources.
Right, they could.
They do.
They use
$1 trillion of money that could be used for other good things.
All right, you have any friends there who are also working on computer viruses?
We don't really directly fight, or, you know, we're not involved in computer viruses other than, like everybody else, unwilling recipients.
Right. Though, speaking now back on biological health, what would be the point, the advantage, the benefits of being able to sequence more people or everyone?
Okay, so I think...
Unless there's anything more you want to say about the mechanics and the of reducing the cost through better engineering.
There's a variety of methods that we and others are developing in addition to the two that I've already mentioned,
right,
that are give it hope.
And what do you expect the outlook for the next 3 to 5 years in finding the breakthroughs or applying the ones you've already got?
I think it's going to be great because finally the NIH has put its full weight behind the technology development. NIH had been focusing mainly on production.
Right.
Now that we produced the first human genome sequence, now they realize that we can't just keep doing it by the same method. And now, finally, they're making a commitment to technology development. So I think what will happen is the same thing with the Genome Project. When they announced they want to do production, everybody stepped in. It was a wonderful community effort, and I'm sure the same thing will happen with engineering.
Right. Now, speaking of NIH, I've been doing some interviews about the Center for Computational Biology at Princeton and related centers of excellence that are going to do a lot more computational or quantitative biology. Does the advent of more computing power through NIH and other places bode well for what you're trying to do?
Maybe it's the other way around. Is if there are more DNA sequences and the things you can do with DNA sequences, it will make the computational tasks much, much easier. They'll have more data to work with, it'll be cleaner data, and the computational challenges will become less significant.
Okay. Now, we're about to talk about the benefits and the point of doing all this, apart from just the intellectual curiosity.
The benefits are, I mean, clearly this is something that anybody who wants it should be able to get it.
Right.
Then people have to ask, I mean, there's no reason to force on anybody, but anybody who... So they should know why would I want it.
Right.
So what happens is increasingly cancers are how you treat cancers depends tremendously on what the sequence of the genes are in the cancer relative to the rest of your body.
Right.
And so that's becoming a clear application, probably one of the first real home run hits for personalized medicine. If you try the wrong drug or the wrong amounts of drug for a particular person,
right,
you can't just use the one-size-fits-all that works in many other fields of medicine. For example, the EGFR and ERISA story, which just came out. ERISA is a great drug if you have certain mutations in your EGFR gene, and it's not such a great drug if you don't.
So, in fact, what the issue is that before you start attacking the cancer cells, you want to know what the genome of the cancer cells is and what the human genome of the host is, so that you can essentially tailor the agents to kill the cancer cells and leave the human person there who's hosting them alone.
Exactly. I mean, you're not really tailoring them on the... Yeah, you're tailoring them in the sense you're choosing from drugs that have already been heavily tested.
Right.
You just need to know which drug to use for each patient. So it's a wonderful example of how personalized medicine is coming into being.
But again, because I imagine it's relatively easy to get the genetic fingerprint of the cancer, but... And you would know, and then you'd have five different drugs you could use against it. But some of them would be better or worse for the person who's got the cancer.
Exactly.
And you need their DNA profile in order to choose which one to use.
Yeah, you need their normal profile and their cancer profile.
Right. Okay. Now, has that been done anywhere yet?
Oh yeah, it's widely done to deal with the differential toxicity and efficacy of certain drugs. And the example I just gave of the EGFR ERESA is being done through the clinical trials and probably will be the method of choice for all people that have lung cancer.
Now, the same thing, what you just said a few minutes ago about the 13 markers that are used for criminal investigation DNA profiling, is it necessary to have a complete genome of a cancer patient, or are there analogous 13 or 30 or 50 or 100 markers that are enough, and you only have to do them?
I think that probably the part of the genome you need to do for cancer is considerably more than the 13 markers you need for DNA fingerprinting,
right?
And probably considerably less than the entire genome. But as each year the number goes up. In fact, it's recently been going up at an extremely high rate. The number of genes and segments within the gene, so you have to really do the whole gene. And it's enough, and it's finally spread throughout the genome enough that it may actually be more expensive to try to do it piecemeal than to do it all at once.
Right, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
What are some other examples of current or immediately future personalized medicine that individual gene sequencing can make possible?
Well, I think one thing that you can imagine that is that if you had your complete genome fairly early in your life, you could go through it and ask for all the things that might be most likely to be alarming, right?
Right.
Not necessarily alarm, it's just things that look like they either have been found in other people to cause problem, you know, things that are known to be involved in cholesterol metabolism or predispose you to cancer or metabolic disease and so forth. And you just make a ranked list of them, and you just go a little bit down the list and you say, well, rather than trust this as my destiny, I'm going to get some early diagnostics.
Right.
I'm going to say, maybe this one tells me I should get my colonoscopy 10 years earlier than my parents did.
Right.
And so having that, you can basically go on a fishing expedition for all the diagnostics you should do a little earlier. And that could save people on average. Some people won't save anything. Other people, it could save them a decade of life and thousands of dollars. And over all of society, it almost certainly will save us lots of money and important years of our lives.
Okay, now on the subject of all of society, what benefits, both sort of academic and theoretical, are there, and what benefits, practical and social, would there be to have, let's just fantasize here, it's a thought experiment, we got 36 million people in California, let's say we figure out a way to get all of their sequences done. Presumably this would provide a lot of grist for a lot of academic mills and medical research mills to find out things. What kind of things could be found out once we had that much data?
There's a difference between the 36 million people getting their own sequence and having those sequences available for medical research. To be available for medical research, they have to give their permission, and they have to be extremely well informed of all the risks, and there has to be some kind of physiological data to go with it. Your genome all by itself is not enough.
Right.
But I'm hoping, we're all hoping that there will continue to be lots of heroes, volunteers, that do involve themselves in medical research. And it could be that once you get your genome sequence, you see exactly which diseases or traits, if you want, you want to get involved in.
Right. Now, in fact, the genes are just the beginning, of course. The genes create proteins, and the proteins get folded, and that creates the body, and then that has manifestations in it. Presumably, you're going to want to have an equally vast amount of information about the actual people who have the sequences, aren't you?
Exactly. So to do the studies, you need to have carefully controlled experiments where, you know, or at least you need to have physiological measurements on the people alongside their genome sequence, and then you can start to make correlations, and then you can do tests.
Right.
And that, I think that this is going to open up a wave of interest in this sort of thing. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Lorenzo's Oil.
No.
But, you know, a family discovers that their child has named Lorenzo, has a metabolic disease, and there's no cure for it, but they go out and they become experts. The family, which didn't have a scientific background, goes out and becomes experts, and they raise money, and they kind of badger the medical establishment into finding a cure, and they do.
Well, so, again, getting back to if we have the genomic data and we have the physiological data and we have other data, and let's say, we're just thinking here, we're not actually going to do this, let's say we're the Department of Homeland Security or the FBI or the CIA or the all-knowing federal bureaucracy or something, to start correlating everything there is to be correlated here.
Well, that's why I stress that 36 million people can get their own sequence, and they can use it however they want. It's theirs. It's nobody else's. If they volunteer to participate in a medical research, they can make it clear that data goes to that medical research and nothing else. If they just want it just to go to cardiovascular research, that's where it's going to go, and they can make that legally binding.
Right.
Now, if a criminal or it wants to go and determine your DNA sequence without your permission, they can do that, but it's against the law. It's illegal seizure, right?
Yeah, it is now. If someone gets
as far as I know, it is against the law, and I don't see why that law would change.
Right.
If anything, the laws are going the opposite way of increasing our privacy with respect to our DNA. But, you know, Homeland Security, if it has, if it has permission from, or it has its mandate, wherever that mandate comes from, it's like anything. I guess they could probably seize your medical records that you already have, or they could seize all sorts of things.
Okay. Well, that's
their prerogative.
Assuming a brave new world rather than a 1984 future.
Yeah.
What would be the increased possibility? What would be the increased possibilities for essentially getting Brad Pitt's nose or Yasha Heifetz's finger dexterity as finally seen as a sequence that could be sold, duplicated, and inserted into future generations?
So, you know, I think there's a big jump from understanding and manipulating.
Right.
And there's a big jump from where we are now in understanding cancers,
understanding
complex things like morphology
of
a nose,
for
example. So I think that's pretty far off, both the understanding and the applications.
You do.
I'm not going to mention years, but I think it's further off than applications like cancer.
Okay. That's good. That's a pressing need.
Yeah. I mean, I think people will tend to focus on pressing needs. They're probably, if they happen to serendipitously find a way to do something cosmetic, they will certainly do it. I mean, but it will have to be cost effective relative to current methods like cosmetic surgery.
Right.
It would have to be lower cost. And I think that's unlikely in the immediate future.
Okay. In the immediate future, let's talk about immune systems, because they're very important and they're very much in the news and they're very much at issue in a lot of the medical stories that are happening right now. It's presumably in the sights of biomedical scientists to understand the immune system better through genetics, right? To understand what gives some bodies more powerful immune systems than others, what compromises anybody's, and so on.
Right.
Once that were understood through this method, would interventions then be likely or possible or cost effective, do you think, in order to essentially enhance immune systems genetically?
Well, I think that's a very important point. Better sequencing offers two avenues to understanding and enhancing the immune system. One is you can understand what might be good or bad about your immune system relative to other ones.
Right.
And So that's on a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You find out what your
type.
Your inheritance is.
Right.
And the other is you can actually assess how your DNA changes in your immune system. Your DNA rearranges to fight to record what it's seen.
Right.
That can be allergies, autoimmune disease, or in response to infectious agents. That's all present as your population of B and T cells, and so you can read their DNA.
Right.
So there's the two ways that it can help, and I think it's very important. It's the best way to manipulate the immune system right now, aside from immunosuppressants and enhancers as we have,
is
vaccines.
Right.
There's a real need to understand why it is that occasionally vaccines fail.
Right.
You know, we would be much more aggressive about producing flu vaccines every year if we knew what the safety issues really were, and that requires more medical research.
And in fact, the kind of thing that you were talking about, personalized medicine, would lead to personalized vaccines.
Absolutely. As long as it can be affordable, yes, you will say, oh, here, this person is likely the one in 100,000 that will react poorly to this vaccine.
Right.
We'll either, you know, not give them any vaccine, if that's the only thing that will keep them healthy.
Right.
Or we'll come up with a custom vaccine.
Right. In fact, it's similar to what you were talking about with being able to hurt the cancer cells without hurting the body.
Exactly.
You want to be able to develop an immunity to a particular virus that's coming in, but you don't want to hurt the body at the same time.
Right.
And if you had that person's sequence, and if you had a lot of people's sequence to know what the types of response were, you would know how to tailor that vaccine just as you were able to tailor the chemotherapy.
Absolutely.
All right. What about the final reach of this ought to be the transformation or the transformation of the genome? Is I don't know much about that. You may know more. Are there possibilities to change the genetic sequence in a person through biomedical intervention, or is that a goal that's being worked on that would be more feasible? In other words, you've got a not so good immune system. Well, you get a new one and you put it in.
Right.
Can that be the genes for that? Can that ever be done?
That can be done. It's sometimes given the label gene therapy, or
right.
in the cases cell therapies.
Right.
I think that we're getting better at it. And it requires, just like drugs and vaccines, it requires a lot of testing, and there will be failures that will involve, you know, heroes that have volunteered to do the work and have gotten sick as a consequence.
Right.
But it's actually, a lot of people get stem cell transplants now. They'll get their hematopoietic stem cells from their bone marrow.
Those are the ones that make blood, right?
That's right. And those cells will be, this is a fairly routine medical practice for people who get a variety of treatments that would harm their own stem cells. They keep some of theirs aside, or they'll
right.
get a donor that's compatible with them. And that's the sort of cell that you could begin changing. So if you had an immune problem, you could alter your blood stem cells and come up with a slightly better immune system. But the technology is still in the early days.
Right.
It's not like drugs and vaccines yet.
Right. Or a lot better, so that it not only did what the last one did, but it made more of itself faster, or it carried more hemoglobin, or
yeah.
whatever it had to do. Say a little bit, since you've brought up the subject, about the stem cell initiative in California and how you view that, and whether you think Massachusetts is going to respond in kind or what?
Well, I think in a certain sense, Massachusetts, not necessarily as a state, but in some certain private concerns, like Harvard University has done a stem cell initiative
right.
where they put their money on the line and have developed some new stem cell lines.
Right. In fact, it was a Howard Hughes stem cell that led to the pigment epithelium a breakthrough at Advanced Cell Technology, wasn't it?
Right. So there's a Harvard and Howard Hughes, which is nationwide, actually international organization,
right.
Have made a commitment. And it would be wonderful if California made a commitment as well, and the federal government, for that matter, is stepping up to the plate in various ways. This is extremely important. Stem cells and cell therapies really are the wave of the future. I mean, they need critical testing and development and a lot of technology to go into it, but once it arrives, I don't think anybody's going to regret that we have these capabilities. Whether they're adult stem cells or some other stem cell will be determined with time.
Say something about the relationship between your research in genomics and stem cells.
Well, we recently got a grant for a Center for Excellence in Genome Science to apply to develop new sequencing methods that are more cost effective and apply them to adult stem cells. In principle that the technology is generic and can be applied to any kind of cell, any organism,
right,
at all, but we chose to put it in the context of the stem cell.
So this is an idea. So this is using your genomic sequencing technology to characterize the stem cells,
right?
So that you
characterize
can
both their genomes and their RNA.
Right. Okay. Final question: what about lowering the price of doing this by ordering a big order, by getting 36 Californians, by getting 280 million Americans? How could that drive the price down and speed up the time when more people could have personalized medicine?
Well, I think we need to avoid the situation where a lot of people get their expectations up on a particular time frame. But there's no question, we see this in many industries, that higher volume will drive the prices down by learning curves and encouraging engineers to develop better technologies. I think NIH is beginning to encourage that. It needs to be ramped up in a careful manner rather than too much of a crash program. But I would say we're certainly not at the point now where we're spending too much money on either stem cells or on personal genomics. Both of those could use more. It will take, you know, good policy management to decide exactly how much and when, but certainly it deserves the same kind of attention the Genome Project got. You know, $3 billion over 10 years would be a great thing.
Well, in
or
fact,
more.
$3 billion is the price tag of is the output. $6 billion is the price tag for the stem cell initiative in California.
And it also coincidentally is the amount of money we spent on the Human Genome Project nationally over a 10-15 year period.
So the researchers are ready to spend more money, and the government isn't exactly ready. That would mean that if the population started demanding this, if they all said, instead of "I want my MTV, I want my genomic sequence," then there might be some movement.
That would be fantastic.
As one of your students found out, there's something called the Californians for Universal Voluntary Individual Genetic Sequencing that would essentially try to get an initiative on the California ballot to spend a lot of public money to speed up the process. Does that sound like something that might...
That sounds like a wonderful initiative, very visionary of California to think of such a thing. And but I don't think it's not too soon to get started on it. It'd be great if the people spoke out like that. It would be a historic moment. It'd be very interesting to see how to. But I would stress that it needs to be phased in carefully with lots of oversight.
Right. Of course. Maybe you could help do some of the oversight. Obviously, it takes fewer signatures to get an initiative on the Massachusetts ballot, so maybe there could be a competition there as well.
That would be fun. That's fun to watch the competition.
All right. That's great. It's been great talking to you. Thanks. And unless there's anything particular else that you feel needs to be said about this, I'll thank you and let you get back to the lab.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you very much. Okay. Talk to you later.
Yeah, okay, bye.
Bye.